Welcome back to Lo-Fi Lit. My name's Tyler Byrne, and this is a podcast where I interview authors, writers, poets, publishers, and anyone and everyone else that I find to be interesting. Today on the podcast, I'm talking to Wallace Barker. He has recently published Gypsy Romance, a translation of Garcia Lorca's poetry. It is published under Farthest Heaven Press. Before we begin, a quick note. We didn't go much into Lorca. I recommend the podcast In Our Time titled Lorca, L-O-R-C-A. It is a great podcast. It's only about 50 minutes, and they go into the history and the poetry of Lorca and the politics and his life and his relationships with Dolly. I highly recommend you listening to that. Wallace lives in Austin, Texas. He is friends with August Smith and Stephanie Duhem. The podcast that August operates is called Not Fit for Composition. It came out yesterday, actually. It is a fun listen if you want to know more about Stephanie and August and August's friends, Marcus and Eleanor. It is a fun podcast. They talk about like popular culture and poetry. All right. This is Lo-Fi Lit with Wallace Barker. You're nervous?
I'm a little nervous.
Why?
I don't know. I just haven't done many of these.
Yeah? Have you ever thought about doing your own?
Not really, to be honest. No. I've thought about doing other kind of, not similar, but other types of things, like maybe a lit mag or something, but I've never thought about doing a podcast.
You have a lot of experience. You seem like you would know a lot of information about alt-lit. I mean, you started, what's the first publication that you were in?
I think it was Benango Street. Like we had been kind of messaging about earlier, but I think that was probably my very first publication. I might've like submitted to some like print mags before that were super low circulation, but that was the first thing that like had any kind of online visibility.
How'd you find out about Benango? Because was it alt-lit at the time? Were they like referring to themselves as that?
Yeah. I think it was pretty well like in the initial like alt-lit 1.0 era. I found out about it because, man, I hosted a reading at my house, and a guy named Justin Carter read. I don't know if you know him or at all. He was kind of involved in those days in alt-lit stuff. He's still a poet, actually. Went and got an MFA and actually I think just has a new collection that came out, but yeah, we just kind of hit it off and he was a writer. A woman named Rachel Hyman ran the mag, and I don't know what she's up to. I don't ever see anything about her anymore, but he kind of connected me with her, and so I just started. I think I first wrote like a kind of a guest piece for it, and then they were like, oh, you know, you could write more regularly.
So, but you knew the before you said you were you set up a reading at your house.
Yeah.
So were you in the poetry scene before you were publishing?
Just as kind of like an observer. So this is kind of a little bit of a crazy story, especially due to like things that happened later. But so I was just sort of like following alt-lit at that time, total just observer. And Steve Rogenbuck, who you may know, posted somewhere that he wanted to do a reading in Austin, which is where I live. And he was like looking for a venue. And so I just kind of responded and said, you know, I'll host if you want, but it's just a house. And he accepted. And so I hosted. And Justin Carter read, a few other kind of alt-lit adjacent people read too.
So was he following you?
No, I don't think so. I was following him. I guess it was on Twitter because I've never really been like a Facebook guy, but I don't think he was following me. I don't recall that he was.
And were you in college at the time?
No, it was actually after college. I was already working and everything.
Okay. Did August Smith go to these?
No, this is before I met August. This may like kind of predate when August was all that involved. This is probably like 2010 or something. I don't know. August is younger, so I don't know. He would have been like pretty young at that time.
And were you into, were you, did you like go into writing in college? Like, what was your major?
English, and I did a lot of
Okay.
creative writing. Actually had it was like an English major with a creative writing emphasis is what they called it.
Okay. What
Yeah.
were you planning on like doing an MFA after?
Yes, I was, and I applied for MFAs and got rejected. I applied for three
Really?
MFAs, yeah, three programs and just got rejected from all three.
Did you apply again ever?
No. I was going to. That was my original plan, was like, oh, I'll just apply again. But then I started working and I was working like just kind of real sort of low wage hourly jobs. I was like, man, I want something else. So I decided not to go get an MFA.
Do you wish you, I mean, you're like publishing now, so I guess it doesn't matter.
Yeah, and now honestly, I don't really. I mean, at the time, I wanted to go to get an MFA just because it seemed like the logical thing to do. I didn't know what else to do with my life, basically. But like, in retrospect, I'm glad I didn't. I'm not a fan of MFAs as like a way to become a better writer.
Yeah. But you found a community though. You found the alt-lit. You're really like at the start of it.
I was, but I was never any like of any note. I was just an observer who kind of interacted a little bit with people involved from time to time, but I don't think anybody knew me or knows me, or I'm pretty low.
You played the long game. You just like stayed in it.
You could say that.
And then I was reading the reviews you showed me that you wrote for Bonanga Street. You were really like, you were putting like historical like figures in there. Like you were putting like credited like poetry writers like in like poetry canon or whatever. And I kind of like respected that because you weren't just paying attention to the alt-lit people. You had a mix. You were like educating people.
Yeah, well, honestly, from the very beginning, I've always been a big fan of alt-lit, which I think is different than a lot of other people who are participants and stuff who kind of tend to run from it a little bit, I've always thought it was great and super cool that it had like a kind of a unified. And so I very much like wanted to sort of position alt-lit with kind of canon stuff. And so yeah, I think that was like a conscious attempt in some ways to like put them side by side, because I thought and still think that it's sort of like a literary movement that is, like every bit as valid or like meaningful as prior literary movements. Like
What
I've
do
always
you?
thought, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, you're good.
I was gonna say, I've always thought that like to me, what alt-lit most closely resembles is like the Beats, right? It's very similar, like a youth-led movement that sort of shakes up the establishment, in which the establishment kind of dismisses and is derogatory toward, but ultimately is really what was most interesting in literature at the time,
What do you take away, like the positive things that you take away from that early alt-lit places that you published in and the communities you found?
Oh, I mean everything. It kind of like I had given up on writing because like I only thought of writing as like I guess New York publishing or the MFA sort of network of, so I didn't th I thought I was shut out of any potential way or to write or anything. And then when I discovered Alt Lit Online, I was like, it really just inspired me to like an extreme degree, because I think I've been listening to your podcast and I've heard other people kind of say similar things where it's like I didn't know a normal person could write and that people would read it, outside of established like avenues.
Do you think that was kind of your MFA experience though? Like equivalent to that?
I,
Like
you know,
getting
I
into
don't.
like a, you're writing for a magazine and stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing about an MFA, to the extent that there's something like positive in my view about them, it's just that like you can set aside 2 years to focus on writing and not work, assuming you get some sort of like stipend or something. But so I never had that. I was always like part time, trying to squeeze it in between everything else. So that's, I think it definitely was that in terms of like communing with other writers and like collaborating them, but I never had that like here's 2 years just to focus exclusively on writing,
So after the reading that you set up and then you start publishing in the mag, did you go to New York? Were you living in Austin at the time?
I've always lived in Austin, yeah. I'm like a townie. I've never lived anywhere else, and I've never been in New York for any literary purposes. I've been there just as a tourist, but I've never, yeah.
Because I saw you got published in the like Keep This Bag Away from Children, and I thought that was like a reading series in New York. Was that also a magazine?
Yeah, I just submitted to I can't remember. That was actually run by somebody who was pretty cool, like somebody pretty prominent in the scene. I can't remember anymore who it was, but
I know Maggie Lee dated the guy that ran it.
Yeah, exactly. Wow, you've got an encyclopedic kind of knowledge yourself.
I'm like obsessive over a few people, and then like everything else I don't know.
I'm like that too. I paid super close attention back then, and I still try to now. But yeah, so that's right. Maggie Lee, awesome writer who was part of the scene back then. I don't know what she's up to now, but yeah, the guy who dated her, who was also awesome, I just can't think of his name or anything. Yeah, he ran that, and so I just had like lots of respect for them, and so I submitted.
So you never went to like the Mellow Pages place?
No, I dreamed about it. You know, that was one of the things about the early outlet that I would say is missing from the current one, is like there was a lot of coverage of the cool like parties and things people were doing and readings. And so being like a fan of early outlet was, a lot of it was just like looking at photos from parties where all these people that I was respected so much had attended. And of course I was never invited, and they were always in towns where I couldn't have gone anyway. But yeah, I think like, I wish that there was something like that now, where there was like a central clearinghouse for like the characters of alt-lit, so you could keep track of like the cool stuff they were doing, you know? Mm-hmm. 'Cause back in the day you had alt-lit gossip and you had Pop Serial, which both sort of did that. They just consistently chronicled like the cool stuff people were doing, you know?
Mm-hmm. Have you thought about doing that?
Like, I have thought about it, but I'm not the right person for it.
Why not?
I'm too old and I don't have enough time, but, yeah. But I think like it's necessary, it's needed, you know? I mean, I think alt-lit, like the genius of alt-lit is like, it's an amazing marketing thing to like bring eyeballs to writers who would otherwise not get them. And so part of that is like not just promoting and publicizing the work, but also the people, the events, you know, I think there's a real audience out there for it, but nobody's really doing that anymore, you know?
Were there any writers that inspired you at first that like now have fallen off? That you wish would come back?
That have fallen off. There's definitely writers who've inspired me. I'm trying to think of somebody who's fallen off that. I mean, I'm sure the answer is yes, but I don't want to list any names because I don't know. Fallen off seems like negative. I don't, you know.
No, I mean like Spencer Mattson. Like, I know he doesn't write anymore.
Yeah, I like Spencer. I liked, I thought Sorry House was super cool. I liked a lot of what they published. I never liked his writing as much. Like, he had that cat poem that kind of went viral. I thought that stuff was a little bit corny, but yeah. But I love what he did as like, you know, in terms of his publishing house and everything. I think he published Mira Gonzalez's book, right?
Yep.
Yeah, which, that's an awesome book. I mean, that's an incredible book. And she's great.
Did you ever get into Shabby Doll House?
Nah, I wish. That's another super cool publication. Everybody involved in that is rad. I would have loved to, but no, I think I submitted.
So when did you get into like Lorca?
More like college. I kind of learned about him in college, and then had just like, I was always interested in his like the region he was from and his life and all that. I always liked his poetry too, but like, I really got like fascinated by that Andalusia where he's from. And so, so I just kind of always carried that with me, you know?
So you started getting into him in college, and then over the past like decade, you just like looked into him every now and then. When did you decide to like write this translation? That's a hardcore thing to go do, is like write a translation of someone's work.
Yeah, totally. Well, more recently, I guess as I've gotten older now, I've like finally had like the resources to go to Andalusia and do it. So, you know, that was a big part of the project, was I did the translation whilst living in Andalusia. And so, you know, that never seemed attainable till more recently, as, you know, I don't know, my career has gone along and stuff.
You chose to live there? I thought you were just vacationing there. That's crazy.
Well, no, yeah. I guess I'm giving myself too much credit by saying live there. I spent a couple weeks there. You can call it living or vacationing.
But still, that's really impressive that you decided to go to the place where the poetry had been written. That's a huge commitment.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of it was just, I just wanted to go. It seemed like super cool. I've always wanted to visit the place. But another part of it is like a big thing in my own poetry and sort of my poetry project is like place and the influence of place. Mm-hmm. And so I like poets who seem like they're sort of like closely tied to a place, you know? And I like to write in different places. My first collection was a collection of poetry that's actually like travel poetry written in different places. And so, yeah, so I thought, wouldn't it be cool to do a translation in the place where the original poet wrote it, and kind of like how would being in that place impact the translation, you know?
Sounds like a novel.
Yeah. I mean, I think like for novelists, that's more taken for granted. Like, you know, oh, the novel's set here. Or you'll even hear people talk about like, oh, the place is like a character in the novel, you know? It's, you know, if it's a novel that really is like, has a lot of like atmosphere related to the place and stuff. But you don't, people, it's less explored as a concept in poetry, I think, you know? Like, yeah.
Did you feel like you had to go? It was like a must.
I felt like I was pretty obsessed with that region and what I had learned about it. You know, I don't know how much you know about it, but it's like
No.
it was ruled by the Moors for like a really long time, like 700 years. So, you know,
Whoa.
Muslim Arabic conquerors. And so it has like a strong kind of Arabic influence, but of course then it was reconquered by the Spanish, so it's obviously part of Spain and Spanish. And then it also has like this big gypsy population, so it's like Arabic, Spanish, gypsy. Like, it's a really interesting culture to me. I've always wanted to like check that, just see it, you know?
So there is a note about the gypsies in the first of the book. Is that like a derogatory thing or something?
I don't think that the word gypsy is derogatory. I don't have any problem with it, but actually like other people told me, oh no, you shouldn't use that word. You should use Roma or something like that.
Really?
Early readers who had read it were like, I recommend you use Roma. But you know, the Spanish word is gitano, and I didn't want, like, Roma just didn't seem anything like that. Plus, Roma is not a word that Lorca would have ever used. It didn't exist when he lived. So it was like anachronistic, you know? So I knew I wanted to use gypsy because I think it's a cool word. It has like all kinds of like cool connotations, like mysterious, artistic, kind of roguish a little bit in a fun way, I think, you know. But yeah, people told me it was like a derogatory word. So I.
So when you went to live down there like for a few weeks, did you take your whole family?
Yes.
They were down for the project. Did they get annoyed that they had to go?
No, I think everybody had fun. It was fun to be in that place, you know.
So what was it like those few weeks? What was like some surprises that you weren't expecting to take away?
Well, I didn't know until I got there that like the gypsy population lives like in caves on a particular mountain.
Wait, what?
Yeah, there's a mountain there kind of in the middle of the town, really, or kind of off to the side a little bit. I mean, it's relatively like, it's all pretty condensed area, but yeah, there's a mountain called Sacromonte that's full of caves, and they like put kind of like this lime paint all over the walls, but like, so it's like caves that the interior is like all white. And
What does the paint do?
I don't know. I think it just like keeps it, otherwise it would just be dirt, I guess. You know, it just kind of like
Okay.
holds it together, keeps it from like, I don't know, just falling apart or something. I don't know.
What's the population here that they all live in caves? Is it all one big cave or is it like little tiny caves?
No, it's like a collection. It's just like all through the mountain, there's like these winding paths that go up to eventually to the top.
Are they like catacombs?
Well, they're individual. They're like houses. They're not like
Okay.
connected to one another. They're just
Now,
like,
are they built into the mountain?
yeah, it's like a door that opens up into the mountain and you just go into a cave. Yeah, there's no
But like
windows.
did they construct the caves? Like are they man-made caves? Or they were like,
Yeah, I think, you know, originally the gypsies just lived in like caves they found, but over hundreds and hundreds of years, they kind of built them out into like more home-like structures, you know.
so what's the distance between one cave to another cave? Are they really close?
Yeah, like kind of like the distance between two houses on a street, you know. As you follow
Wow.
this path, there's like a series of doors, and each door represents like a different cave house. You know, they have addresses and like mailboxes now, you know.
Whoa, do you have any pictures?
Yeah,
This?
I do. I do have pictures. Yeah, lots.
I might post one for the cover
Yeah,
title or
I'll
something.
send you a bunch. Yeah, I'll send you a bunch of pics.
And so are the doors like painted like different colors or are they just like the color of the mountain?
No, yeah, they're like wooden doors painted. Yeah, different colors. I think the one we stayed in had like a green or red door, but yeah, they're all different. And then they often have like there's the path, there's like the cave house, and then a path, and then there'll be like a garden. Andalusia, one of its like key characteristics are like hidden gardens. Every house will have like some sort of courtyard style garden, which is a very like Arabic design feature. A lot of it's very common in Arabic places for there to be like an inner sanctum garden. Because you got to remember, Arabic women don't leave the house, or traditionally only leave the house if they're covered and stuff. So there's a lot of emphasis in Arabic like architecture around sort of inner sanctum places. And so there's all often like an inner courtyard. And so that persists in Andalusia. So the gypsy houses that are caves will also have like a little walled off like garden across from them.
Do they have like lawn ornaments? Are there like flamingos?
No, because it's more like door to a cave, like dirt path that winds up the mountain. And then like on the other side of the path, there'll be like a garden that's walled off. And then it's like a sheer drop off the mountain right there.
So is it like, is the garden, is it owned by all the people in the caves? Or is it like each cave has its own garden?
Each cave has its own, kind of like a front yard, you know?
Okay.
Yeah.
When it's Christmas, do they like hang lights?
I don't know. I don't know what the gypsy traditions are around Christmas and stuff. I was there in the summer, so I don't know what they do on Christmas.
Do they celebrate like Halloween? Do people like walking to eat?
I really don't know. I don't know what the gypsy. They're like they're quite poor. So I stayed in one of these cave houses. And
you did? Were there rooms like within the cave? Are there separate rooms?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And what does the bathroom look like?
It's like a separate room. I mean, there's not like any 90 degree angles or anything. It's just like cave wall. So it's all kind of, and it's like very jagged and like rocky and stuff. And then they'll just have like, yeah, a room that's like the bathroom, you know?
Is there lighting?
Yeah. They have like wiring going through there with like, you know, really primitive, almost like exposed bulb type lighting, you know?
Do they have like TVs?
I don't think there was a TV in the one I stayed in. Yeah. No.
Cool. Were there like huge bookshelves? I'd imagine they probably read a lot.
There's the you know, we just stayed in like via Airbnb or whatever, and there was a lot.
Wait,
of
there was an Airbnb cave?
Yeah, you can just totally find them on Airbnb.
Oh, that's
awesome. Yeah, I think the people have figured out that they can make money that way. But like other gypsies would come by our place and try to sell us stuff all the time.
For like cool stuff?
No, like popping cans, like more like just sort of secondhand junk type stuff, you know.
Were you like, leave me alone?
We sometimes just gave them money. Like, here's, sorry. You know, because if you decline to purchase it, then they're like, well, can you give me anything? You know what I mean? Okay. Help me, please, you know?
Did they know also that you were out of town? So you probably had money?
I mean, yeah, I think when they talked to me, I think they knew I wasn't a gypsy. Mm-hmm. Maybe, I don't know. But
would you be a gypsy if you could be?
I don't think so. No, I think it's a rough existence. You know, I don't mean, I'm not an expert on gypsy, you know, what their lives are like or anything. Although I've done actually a fair bit of research, to be honest. But for the most part, I think they live pretty rough lifestyles.
So how far from the caves was like Lorca's place?
So Lorca grew up with his family. So Lorca's family was rich because his dad was a sugar beet farmer. And then and that wasn't all that great, except that Spain lost Cuba during the Spanish-American War. They previously had Cuba, and they were importing a ton of sugar cane or sugar from sugar cane out of Cuba. And when they lost Cuba, they had to source like all their sugar internally. So all of a sudden, like overnight, his dad became rich because he was a sugar beet farmer.
Oh, wow.
And so Lorca's family lived outside of Granada on a farm. But they also had a home in Granada. And so the Sacromonte is like here's Granada. And then just like right next to it is Sacromonte, the mountain. So it's all kind of right there. And Lorca had a home more in the city, not on Sacromonte.
Did you visit like his home?
No, I didn't. I mean, no, I guess the answer is no. I think he grew up on the farm, but his family had like a city house that they would visit, you know, sometimes. So I don't know. I don't think that they make a huge fuss over it there necessarily, you know.
Is this where you hung out with like Salvador Dali and the homophobic guy?
No, that was in Madrid. So he went off to college in Madrid, although he really didn't go to college. He just kind of lived in a dorm in Madrid. And Dali and Luis Buñuel, the homophobic guy, were at that college with him.
Is that guy okay or not okay?
Well, he's extremely famous and people love him. You know, he's a surrealist director who made like a number of like really like important surrealist movies. Mm-hmm. So his like reputation as an artist is, you know, massive, but he was quite homophobic. He wrote a biography where he talks about that himself. And I guess like in his youth, he would like physically assault gay men, with his friends and stuff.
On the list of evil things that poets and authors have done, where do you rank this guy?
Oh, probably pretty, I don't know, pretty low. I mean, there's some real scoundrels in the, in, you know, in the artistic ranks, I think.
So do you give him a pass?
Do what?
Do you give him a pass, kind of?
I mean,
you still enjoy his art and stuff?
I think he was a jerk. I don't necessarily love his art personally. That's probably gonna, like, I think a lot of people really do, so that's fine. I don't have a problem with people who do, but, like, I don't give him a pass. No, I think he's probably a, you know, a jerk, but
okay.
Yeah.
I thought it was cool, like, I guess if you were, like, a surrealist at the time, that, like, this new technology of film was coming up, and, like, it really, like, emboldened or, like, exasperated, like, what they could do with their art form.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, yeah, I think that there was so much, like, unexplored territory. I mean, there's probably, like, an equivalent now. I don't know what it would be, like.
So, anyways, didn't Lorca, like, didn't he, I was listening to a podcast about him earlier. Like, he also, like, wrote plays.
Yeah, actually, you know, he was mostly a poet in his youth, and then he wrote poetry throughout his life, but
yeah,
he got famous as a poet in his youth, and then, like, kind of pivoted to plays. And that's really where he, most of his, like, financial success was from doing plays, popular plays.
Did you perform any of his plays?
Oh, no, I never have, no.
No? Did you ever think about it?
Not really. I'm not, I mean, I'm not that into plays, I guess. Or, I mean, okay. I like watching, I suppose, but, like, my interest has always been on the poetry side, you know. I haven't even read his plays, honestly.
Have you gone over where he was at after college in Madrid?
No, I've never been to Madrid.
So why did you choose the place that you went and not other places?
Because that's where he wrote the specific collection I was translating.
Oh,
yeah, yeah. Okay. I wanted to be in the location where he wrote it.
Did you try to find exact locations, like where he was?
No, I didn't. I just was in the city, really. I mean, I went to locations he talks about and stuff. Like, in Granada, like, the most famous landmark is the Alhambra, which is a castle, palace that was built by the Arabic Moors. But then it was taken over by the Catholic Spanish. And so it's like this blend of, like, Arabic and Catholic design. And so, yeah, we visited there, like, places that come up in the collection. But I didn't, it wasn't like trying to retrace footsteps necessarily.
So your wife and don't you have kids?
Yeah.
They were cool with staying in the cave.
Yeah, I mean, the cave is nicer than you think. It's okay. Not. It's more. It's basically like a hotel room. It's not. It's not super primitive. I mean, it's got a kitchen and a sink and bathrooms and all that. You know, it's.
But the floor, like, what was the bed situation?
It had beds. It had normal.
Was it cordoned off by curtains?
I think some of the rooms. Yeah, I think the rooms were separated by curtains. I think, like, the bathroom had a door, but everything else was just, like, curtains. Yeah.
Were there any, like, norms or mores that you had to follow or traditions you had to follow out of respect for the gypsies?
Not that I'm aware. No, I didn't make any special effort to do anything unusual like that. No.
Okay. Like, if you, like, didn't accept food from them, they would be, like, pissed off.
I don't know about any traditions like that. I didn't do anything like that. I did go see a lot of gypsy performances. There's, like, gypsy bars that cater to gypsies. And then they'll have performances of, like, gypsy guitar players and singers and dancers. And I went to a lot of that kind of stuff.
And they're cool with you being there. They're not, like, pissed off.
Yeah. I mean, they're making money off the tourist trade, you know?
Okay.
The ones that are more, like, authentic are often just, like, a window out of somebody's cave house. They'll build a window and they'll sell drinks. And then the kind of, like, gypsies just gather on, like, tables on, like, a patio outside the house. Those felt a little more like it would be weird for me just to pull up and, like, start hanging out with everybody, because it was, like, almost felt like people who knew each other and stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't do as much of that. I mean, I went to those places, but it always felt a little bit like it wasn't something where they're looking for tourists to hang out. But there are lots of gypsy bars that are, like, you know, selling tickets to performances and things, you know?
So you were down there, were you translating as you're going through and visiting these places, or were you doing it back in the cave?
All over. I just took a notebook around I had a collection of the poems in Spanish, and I just took a notebook with me. And so I'd go to, like, anywhere that I was walking, courtyard, squares, the Alhambra and the grounds around it. And yeah, just everywhere.
So how different Because you probably read these poems before. Did you already kind of know how you're going to translate it?
Well, I knew what I didn't like. One of the reasons why I decided to do it is because I thought the translations I could find were all bad, really terrible.
Like, there's how bad?
Well, there's old ones from more of, like, from when he wrote it, but they're very stilted in their language. They use, like, almost, you know, like, thou type stuff and all that. You know, it's just, like, very old-fashioned way of writing. Mm-hmm. And then there's newer ones that do weird things with them. Like, I think one problem with translation a lot of times is, like, the translator is like a Spanish scholar, like a Spanish PhD or something. And so they're not poets. So they don't really like bring that kind of mindset to it. So like a lot of things bugged me about the new translations. Like they used words that were anachronistic that didn't make sense in Lorca's time, or they like totally reordered the words, even putting like things on different lines where they didn't belong and stuff. It's like they're more interested in like conveying the meaning of the words than like trying to preserve like the original, you know, structure of the poem, I guess.
Were there scholars that you had reached out to and like discuss this?
No, I just, well, I have a, one of my professors from college is a poet and translator. And so I kind of talked to him a little bit about it,
mm-hmm.
but, not, I guess the answer is not really.
Why isn't this like, because you're publishing this kind of on an indie press.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you try to find bigger, like, established presses? I don't know.
No, I just did it, and then I got connected with Farthest Heaven, Bill, the publisher of Farthest Heaven, through a mutual friend.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, a mutual friend, Steph Duhem. I don't know if you know of Steph Duhem, a poet. Yeah,
yeah, I know.
She connected me and Bill. She knew about the project, and I had been like super lazy and not done anything in terms of like trying to get it published.
Oh, for real?
I didn't.
Well, you had all the poems like already done?
Yeah. I did the whole thing. And then it was a little bit of like an exercise, if I'm being honest, you know, not necessarily like planning to do a book necessarily.
So you weren't planning to make it a book?
Well, I was always maybe like a little hopeful that that could happen, but I was also like, just, it'll be a good experience for me, you know.
But you were doing it for the joy of it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So she connected me with Bill, and he was like, yeah, I'm interested. So we just decided to do it.
But she pushed you to do it?
She's pushed me to do a lot in terms of getting my work out there. Actually, when I first met her, I wasn't really putting anything out there anymore.
Was she irritated with you that you hadn't put it out yet?
No, I won't say irritated. I'll say she's just extremely encouraging. One issue that I've always had around like alt-lit and all that is, there's not really very many people in Austin involved with it. And so I've never had any like IRL people that I know that are involved. And so she moved to Austin for the MFA program, and we met through just like Twitter circles and stuff. And, that's been like hugely, just knowing her has been hugely inspirational for like having somebody who, you know, I can talk to about the stuff I like, you know.
Did you judge her for her, 'cause she was in an MFA?
Well, no, I don't judge her. She's an amazing poet. I don't think she needed to get an MFA for any reason other than maybe just getting the 2 years to work on her stuff. But like,
so you think she shouldn't have gone for an MFA?
I wouldn't second guess any of her decisions. I you'd have to ask her, but I don't think she did anything wrong. You know,
have you hosted readings with her?
Yeah. Hosted? No, but I've read with her, and I've read it reading she hosts. She's like way more active than me. She does a ton of cool stuff.
Have you met Autumn Christian?
No, but that's like her best friend, or, you know, one of her best friends. She talks about Autumn a lot. I'm familiar with who Autumn is, but I haven't met her.
So with Lorca, where was your family at when you were going to the bars? Were they going to other places?
No, I like took my wife with me, you know.
Okay.
Yeah. And my kids were back at the cave.
What do they do in the cave while you guys are gone?
Just hang out. They had like Netflix or something on their on their like iPads and stuff. I think they had movies downloaded and stuff, you know.
Were you like, man, you guys should be out here?
Well, it was bars, you know. I don't take my kids to bars. But.
So what other like things did you do down there?
Let's see.
Like, what does it look like?
It's like hot. Southern Spain is hot, so it's like kind of dusty and a little, it's like olive trees and like cypress trees and grapevine. It's kind of like maybe like Southern California or something.
It's like gorgeous.
Yeah, it's real pretty. I mean, it depends on what you like. It's mountainous. It's a little deserty in places. It's got really pretty beaches. You know, Malaga is like the big beach town in Andalusia.
Now,
If
do they have
you're,
a literary scene down there? But like,
I'm sure they do, but I didn't really engage with it. There's a big university in Granada, so I'm sure that there's, a lot of poets and stuff there.
are there other things that you're writing purely out of joy that maybe right now you're not planning on publishing, but maybe could publish later on?
Yeah, I mean, not so much. So, like, one of the reasons I did this project is because I had just published two like books of original poetry, and I didn't know what I wanted to do next. Like, I want to keep writing, but I didn't want to write the same stuff. I wanted to figure out a way to do something new. So I didn't. I still don't really know what that is exactly, but I wanted to do a project where I could still like stay engaged with it without having to do original stuff. And I'm kind of like still inspired to do stuff with other people's work. I have a few different like ideas for projects that involve other people's work. So I don't, I'm not writing a lot of original stuff right now, unfortunately, although a couple things here and there.
Were you into Lorca's poetry before you looked into like his background, or were you into his background, like his life, before you got into his poetry?
No, the poetry first, for sure. Like I read the, I
Okay.
was introduced to the poetry in college, and then I was like, yeah, I'm more interested to learn about him and end up reading a biography of him and stuff like that.
Do you think if you translate someone's poetry, you have to know about their life? Or do you think it comes from like being passionate enough about the person to do the translation that you want to learn everything about them?
I think it's what you just said, the latter. I think I don't think you have to. I think like I'm a little bit of a sort of like separate the art from the artist type in my mentality. So I think it can almost be like, I think it's like almost negative to get too wrapped up in the biography and the person,
Oh, really?
Well, I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. If you're interested in an artist and you want to like study the artist, go, sure, the life of the artist, but it's fine. But like, I think it's different than studying the art. I think studying the artist is like a historical interest, whereas studying the art is like a literary interest,
Could you write a biography of Lorca?
Well, I've read one, so I could just try to like kind of
Oh.
remember, try to remember what I knew from the biography, but
So
not really, no.
I heard that like they never found his body. What do you think happened? Because
Well,
he was assassinated in 1936, I think.
yeah, that's exactly right. And he was assassinated along with a bunch of people. They were like just
Oh.
steady, like killing anybody who had any kind of leftist associations. So they killed like hundreds, if not thousands, of people. So it was like mass graves and things. So,
Jesus.
and they were also doing it in secret. So they didn't mark anything, and they burned all the records and everything. So that's why they never found the body. It's like who it was probably dumped in some mass grave and then like hidden.
Holy shit. Didn't he publish though? Like, didn't they continue to put out work after his death?
Yeah, things have come out. Yes, there have been collections released since posthumously. Yeah, I'm
So how
pretty.
does your translation differ from other like translation? Is it really like there's a great distance between the two?
I think it's pretty different, yeah, because like there's a lot of things that mattered to me that I didn't feel like other translators ever tried to do. Like for instance, word order. Like for me, like when I'm writing a poem, the first word and the last word of a line are important, right? And just the way the words are ordered, like the translations I read like had no regard for that. They just sort of like conveyed the meaning, but like mixed up the words in whatever way sort of, they I guess was most natural or something. I don't know. So mine is real attentive to like the last word of a line needs to be the last word that he used. And also I'm really big into cognates. Like I try to use a word that sounds similar to what he used, whereas other translators don't seem to care. They just sort of like use whatever English word. But it's hard because like Spanish changes word order. It's like it has different relationship to word order than English. So like for instance, if I was going to say like the red car in Spanish, I would say coche rojo. And so if Lorca was using that phrase, so he said that basically means car red instead of red car, So if Lorca was using that phrase in a poem, the last word of that line would be rojo, red, which is, I think to me, like it's a very different word than car. Car conveys something very different than the color red, in my opinion. And the last word isn't meaningful in any line. And so you have to find ways to like bridge that gap, you know, like I want red to be the last word of this line. But also if you say like car of red, it's sort of like an unnatural, like English speakers really don't talk that way very much. So there's all kinds of weird stuff like that, that I was, I think, more attentive to than any other translation I'd seen, which tended to be like just sort of like, there's different flavors of modern translators. There's poets who do it, who like take a ton of artistic license. And so you'll be reading them side by side and you're like, doesn't even seem like the same poem. And then there's like sort of more like historical languagey scholarly type people who tend to like ignore the poetic elements and just try to render it in like the most direct English, like an English way that seems, I guess, natural to them or something. I don't know. So I was trying to like bridge that gap and be like poetic about it, but also not go crazy with inserting my own, you know, stuff, artistic mm-hmm. license, but also honoring like artistic choices that he made, you know.
Are there any edits that you struggled with?
For sure, yeah, tons. In fact, like when I read it still, I'm like, man, I wonder if I should have done it like a different way or something.
Oh, for real?
Yeah.
You
know,
like some poems you could have like put out more than one variation?
I suppose, yeah, but I mean, would anybody really want to read? That's like, it's too inside baseball, I think. Like, the only people who'd be interested would be other translators, you know?
Maybe if you like wrote like an essay over like translation, and then you included one of those poems and then showed the different ways that you could have gone with it and like what it does.
Yeah. I mean, I would like to. I haven't done that. I'd like to. I actually did some like Twitter threads explaining that. Yeah, like showing how, like taking a original Spanish, showing how some other people had translated it, explaining why I didn't like that, and then showing how I translated it.
Because I feel like people love that inside baseball shit.
You think so? I think it's,
oh yeah.
I would worry it bores people, you know?
No, like literary people love that fucking thing.
Well, maybe I should have done more of that. I don't know. I also had this, like with the book itself, I had this idea that I wanted the product to be as like similar looking to like the original first edition of what he put out.
Mm-hmm.
But I want it to be like very simple. It's a thin volume, you know, it's very simple. It's not, so I didn't want to like load it up with a bunch of my stuff, like notes from the translator. I tried to keep that a little bit to a minimum because I wanted you to feel like you're holding something pretty similar to what, you know, the original felt like.
So when you were down there, did you explain your project to people? Were like people into it, or did you like not really talk about it?
I didn't. I just did it on my own. Nobody asked, and I didn't really make a big deal out of it or anything.
Were there like any historical markers down there that like talks about Lorca or Lorca?
Yeah, there's stuff about it. There's actually a fair bit of graffiti. Like people stencil photos or like pictures of him, and they like will put little saying. Like it's kind of like probably like leftist type graffiti. Then I'll have like a picture of Lorca, you know? So anyway, yeah, there's stuff like that. And there's like little markers about places that he went and things like that. Yeah.
So what's one of the lines that you struggled with?
Oh man, you put me on the spot. there was one that I went over with my editor Bill a lot. Man, what is it? It's like, you're putting me on the spot. It's like, I can't remember the poem it's in, but I'd have to like leaf through the book and find it to be able to speak like intelligently about it. And I don't want to, you know, waste your time.
You're good.
That. Well, okay.
Let's go.
I've got a copy with me as it just so happens.
Nice.
Yeah, man, there was this one.
Did he know about Lorca? Like, was he? How does an editor approach, like someone's translating another book?
Well, I think he mostly kind of like let me do my thing. He didn't insert himself much, but there were a few places where he was like, I don't know how this reads weird to me. And then he and I don't think he speaks Spanish, so you know, he and I would talk about what the original Spanish was and kind of kick around different ideas and stuff like that. But he wasn't, at the end of the day, I mean, he always let me kind of like make a decision, but he was helpful in terms of like pointing out stuff where just as a regular reader, it felt clunky or awkward to him, or he didn't really understand what I was trying to say type stuff, you know? Trying to find, man.
Did you have it all written out like on like a notebook? Like it was all in a notebook?
Yeah, I just wrote it by hand in a notebook. I still have the notebook. Yeah, I just wrote out the poems by hand. Yeah, in
Oh, that's
English.
cool.
Yeah, and then
Did
I typed
you
it.
just like were able to get one poem down and then on to the next, or did you
It took way
struggle?
longer than I thought, man. I was like, my original idea was I was gonna do like maybe two or three of his collections, and then once I got there and started, I was like, oh my God, this is like so much like time consuming than I thought, and so I decided to do one.
Like
So
how
one
so?
poem, I'm sorry.
How is it time consuming?
Well, because like every line I would debate and struggle over, you know, like how can I make this sound natural but also honor his decisions, and like, and then I one thing I did is I. You know, even though I speak reasonably good Spanish, I consulted like a lot of like Spanish thesaurus stuff, and because I don't know like every synonym for every word and things like that. And then I looked at other like probably three or four other translations just to see how other translators had dealt with these problems. So like every line, literally, I'm like consulting Spanish thesauruses. You know, reading other translations and trying to like see how other people did it. So like they just it's really slow. Really slow.
Like what, how long would like one poem take?
Multiple days. Like, I mean, not in terms of like spending dawn to dusk, like working on it, but I would set it down a lot. And then, so yeah, some of the poems, you know, probably I translated over like 2 to 3 days.
Were you not expecting that when you went down there?
Yeah, I wouldn't, I thought I would just burn through it. I thought it would just be like, you know, I'll just knock it out. Maybe I'll do two or three of his collections while I'm there. But yeah, once I got started, I was like, whoa, this is crazy. In fairness, also, like, you know, I didn't spend all my time doing that. I was also just a tourist. I didn't just stay in Granada. I like
Oh, okay.
we rented a car and drove all over the area and did day trips to like all the other little places in the area. And you know, it wasn't like every waking moment was this project, you know.
Were there other poets that you were interested in translating instead of Lorca? Like, why Lorca specifically?
Well, specifically because I was reading a translation, what the genesis of, I've always been interested in them, but the genesis for me, first off, Spanish is my only second language, so it would have to be a poet who wrote in Spanish.
Okay.
But like I was reading a translation, I was like, this sucks. I was going I had only read his poems in English. I'd never even attempted to read them in Spanish, so I didn't know anything about whether the translation was good. And then one day, just for that, because I was curious about something. Well, what happened was I was reading the translation and it was like they had translated something as like skip to my loo, like the children's game or whatever, you know? And I was like, that's weird. Did Lorca know about skip to my loo? Is that a thing in Spain even, you know? And so I went back to the original and what Lorca had said was like step here, then step here, then step here. Like I think he was describing maybe a children's game similar to like the Hokey Pokey or skip to my loo or something like that. But it wasn't skip to my loo. And I was like, that sucks because it's just like that's not even a word that he would have known. It's not associated. Like I just hated that, you know. And that prompted me to start looking at it more closely. And it was like I hated a lot of stuff, a lot of the choices. And I looked at other translations. I was like, these all suck. And then I was like, I could do one that's better. And so that's really what it was. It wasn't like I was sort of like looking for different poets to translate or anything like that. I was like just super dissatisfied with every other translation of Lorca.
Who are these writers that people should be aware of that are bad translators?
Well, I've got one here. Like, I really don't like. This is one that I rely on a lot. This guy's name is the editor's name is Christopher Maurer, but I'm not sure he's the translator actually. I think the translator is a guy named Will Kirkland. I don't know anything about him, and you know, and I don't want to
So
insult Will Kirkland
you got
if he
beef with
doesn't.
him,
Yeah,
translator
I'm
beef.
at peace with Will Kirkland, but I just yeah, he's I didn't like those guys at all what they did.
Are there translators that you really like? Do you think people should check out?
I'm not that smart to be like, you know, knowing any, I don't know any translator. Like I have never
Oh
even like looked into it really, you
yeah? This is
know?
your first like foray into translation.
Yes.
That's
Yeah.
cool.
Yeah. And it was just because I didn't, you know, just this like stumbling upon this thing where I was like, oh man, that's not really what he was saying. Why did they translate it that way? You know?
Have any like translators reach out to you and be like, this is a great translation?
No, I mean it's so small scale. I mean nobody, it's tiny little indie press. It's actually a brand new press. This is the second book it's published.
Well, that's
I don't
cool.
think anybody knows about it other than my friends and my online friends, you know.
So, what did Steph say when she did she read it from
Yeah,
the notebook?
Yeah, so she's a poetry editor for Hobart, and she ran one of the poems in Hobart. She was super encouraging. She was like, "You've got to put this thing out as a collection." She really liked the one that she ran, and yeah, I mean, she was like with everything, just like immensely encouraging, you know.
Yeah, I saw you were in Hobart.
Yeah, that was just one of the poems that's in the collection, and it was because Steph encouraged me to send it to her.
Were you cautious? Like you didn't want to be in Hobart, maybe?
A little, yeah. Yeah, I was actually, yeah, if I'm being honest. Now in retrospect, I don't feel that way at all. I think that like the Elizabeth Ellen side of the Hobart split really won out, because Hobart is, in my view, like so much more interesting than it was prior to the split and compared to any of the other sort of spinoff things, you know? Like,
is that because your friend is an editor for it?
I'm sorry?
Is that because your friend is an editor for Hobart?
Well, I mean, I think Steph's brilliant. I think the stuff she selects is always good. But I think that Elizabeth Ellen had better instincts than, I guess, the other guy that was running it with her was Aaron Birch. And he's more like an academic MFA dude, in my opinion. And she's more like an alt-lit type person. And so the stuff she runs, or maybe the editors she selected, are more like alt-lit people, which I'm not into like academic stuff at all. I love alt-lit stuff, but I'm not into university.
Why don't you and Steph run your own mag with Austin?
Maybe we will. I don't know. I've got an idea for a mag that I want to do, so I haven't talked to Steph about it, but I would, if she was interested, I would 100% want her to be involved.
Yeah, what's the name?
Well, okay. I'm reluctant to talk about it because it may never come to pass. Like, I may never do it. So I don't want people to think like, I don't want people to think like, wow, he failed on that project or something, because I'm not even sure I want to do it. But I've got this whole like thesis around kind of like literary movements. Like, people think about like modernism and postmodernism and all that. And so what are we in now? I guess maybe some sort of like extension of postmodernism. I don't know. I had this idea that sort of, I think those are a little bit fake. I think what really has happened is pop has been the dominant literary movement since, like, I don't know, Andy Warhol, maybe before that. And so we're just in the era of pop, you know. Pop is like completely dominant across all modes of art, and has been, you know, for a long time, almost a century, I'd say. And so I have this idea of like, if you take that thesis as true, and like modernism and postmodernism are really just sort of like genres of pop in a way, or like, you know, modernism is like a proto pop, you know, then it's like, well, what comes after pop? What's post pop, you know? Which I think is a really interesting question, because I don't know the answer.
How do you define pop?
Well, I like, it's that's a good question. How do you define pop? I'm not entirely sure. I think it's a mode of expression that tries to be popular, that is trying to, is influenced by sort of the commercial aspect of art, and therefore is trying to appeal to a wide audience, uses tropes that are popular, that sort of are common to pop. Like, for instance, you could say like a song that's like 2 to 4 minutes long, that's a pop format. A song could be, obviously, can be an hour long, can be 30 minutes long, but that's not pop. You know, if you're releasing 30 minute songs, you're not a pop artist, really. But we know that like pop is nobody listens to anything but pop, you know, it's the dominant mode. So I think, you know, yeah, you have to think about, what if you were making art that had no intention to be popular, that was not designed for that at all? Maybe, but I don't know. I don't know what's pop and what's not pop, but to get back to the magazine, it's like, the idea would be to create like a sandbox for post pop. And I want to solicit writers I like. I don't want to take submissions or anything like that. I just want to solicit writers I like, and kind of like sort of be like, it's a sandbox to play in, like, give us your interpretation of post pop. What do you think post pop is? And I'll give you an example. Like, do you follow like the writing of Tao Lin?
Mm-hmm.
So his more recent poems have been a lot about just like his sort of interest, the same stuff he talks about, like, you know, natural health or like psychedelics or even like political and sort of global conspiracy type stuff, you know. And sometimes the poems are even just like listing those things. Like, it's not even really a commentary on them. It's just like listing these topics, you know? And that is really interesting to me because that feels post-pop, you know? Like, that's not a pop instinct to do that, I think, in a way. He's doing something a little bit post. His whole career, like, after Taipei is a little bit, like, post-pop, you know what I mean? He's gone down a different road, I think. Or I don't know if it truly is post-pop, but it gestures in that direction, you know what I mean?
What do you mean by post-pop?
I mean,
I don't know what that means.
Well, I mean, I think the fact that you don't know what it means, and I don't know what it means entirely either, is exactly what I'm getting at with this lit mag. Like, let's explore it. You know, what does it mean?
But do you mean like pop from like popular culture?
Yes, popular culture, but in a broad sense. Like, I think I was actually talking to Zach Smith about this, and Zach Smith said, "Well, he told me like, well, I think my writing is pop." Zach, he said that, you know, and so pop doesn't mean it's like selling a lot. That's not what it means. It means it has instincts towards being digestible, interacting with popular culture for sure, you know, referencing popular culture. I think, yeah, just being sort of like appealing, you know, or trying to be appealing, you know.
So what was Zach saying about, how was this conversation going between you and Zach?
I talked to Zach quite a bit, like in DMs and stuff, about just all sorts of literary stuff. And we were talking about this idea for a lit mag, and he was like, yeah, I think my writing's pop.
He just came out and said it. Was he like being like an ego guy, like kind of braggadocious about it?
No. He's not like that.
No, he's not.
We were talking about how sort of in a way, all writing, contemporary writing, feels pop in a little bit. You know, it feels like, it's almost like, you know how this is a weird analogy, but like, you know how sometimes like people who are from ethnic minority groups will talk about like how they have a double consciousness. They're aware of people perceiving them, but also people perceiving them as this other thing, you know, the ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think pop is like that. It's like writers exist these days with a double consciousness where they're a writer, but they're also like, they have this like pop observer watching them at all times. And it's like this police officer in their head that's saying like, you know, make it appealing. Are readers going to like this? Are you going to, you know, is this going to be commercially viable? And I don't even mean money. I mean like clout, and is this going to appeal to a broad audience? And so I think what happens if you kill that, you know, pop cop in your brain, you know?
Pop.
Yeah. Yeah.
That should be the magazine title.
Well, maybe, but I already bought the domain for post pop.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Nice. Are you building the site?
No, I need to. Zach recommended I work with that dude. I think his name's like Crow.
What's
the guy's name? The guy that works with him on stuff, I think.
Crow Jonah?
The guy. Yeah. The guy who does HAD. Like involved with HAD. I don't know. I don't know him that well.
Wasn't Aaron Birch from HAD?
Yes, but I think that dude Crow Jonah, like, I think that's his name. I hope I'm not saying his name wrong. You know who I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think he does some of like the more like the maybe like the technical aspects of HAD, like handling the website or something. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So Zach was like, you should work with him because he's like a wizard at the like websites. I don't know anything about creating. I literally don't know anything about putting something online, you know, on a website.
Have you seen August Smith Reed? I feel like that might be post-pop.
Yeah, I have. I love his reading. I was at a reading not too long ago, just a couple weeks ago, where he got up and he was like doing his sort of intro, like, hey, I'm August Smith, this is me, blah, blah, blah. And then he like segued into his poem from his intro in a way that nobody knew he had even segued. And then like, it was really cool. Like, after about 30 seconds, you're like, oh, wait a minute, he's doing his poem now. But it, like, he tricked the audience into like not realizing he'd started. Have you witnessed this?
I saw it at Catch Fest in Philadelphia. I thought he was just like kind of talking, and then he got into this long monologue. I'm like, is this the poem? This is amazing.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I think that's rad. I love readers who do interesting things, who don't just sort of, you know, readings can be dry. Mm-hmm. I love readers who have like interesting ideas. Like, you don't have to necessarily grow up and act like a maniac or anything.
But you want like an entertainer. That's like,
yeah, you want like an entertainer. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think it goes to everything. Like, you know, you should be dressed in a way that you think is entertaining. Like just like a singer would go on stage dressed in a way, like, you know, wearing their sequined unitard or whatever. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not saying you have to do that, but you could. I love August because he has those instincts, you know, entertainer instincts.
So this magazine, would it be entertaining? Like, would you solicit writers to talk about movies or write a scene from a movie?
No, it's art. I don't want their commentary. I want their art, but I want them to think about, like, do you have any art, or can you make art that you consider to be post-pop? And I don't know what that means. It's up to the artist to decide what it means. Tell me what it means, you know?
So what if it ends up being pop, though? Would you, like, reject it?
Well, that's the thing. We're so, like, immersed in pop. Can we escape it? Can we write away from pop? Or is it so, you know, pervasive?
How do you know? How do you know if it's pop or not?
Well, that's what makes it interesting is, like, I don't know. Maybe you just, like, know it when you see it. But can artists break through? Can they get past it? Are we stuck in it? You know, it's kind of tied in. Are you familiar with the ideas of, like, Mark Fisher and, like, hauntology?
No. So,
Or you probably are more familiar with the idea of, like, stuck culture.
What is it?
Like, stuck culture.
What is that? People are stuck?
There's a lot of discourse. And Mark Fisher was a, like, philosopher who sadly committed suicide. But he was, like, really interesting. But his idea was, like, culture is basically stuck. Like, there's nothing new has happened in culture for, you know, 50 years, 100 years. And you see that kind of in all the, you know, the way that, like, Hollywood just recycles IP, and, like, every, you know, there's like 100 billion books in a series because, you know, once you have a hit or something. And so there's this idea that, like, at least maybe since the turn of the century, turn of the millennium, 21st century, it's like stuck. We're stuck. We can't break out of, we're just like recycling culture. We're not creating new culture. And Mark Fisher considered this, like, we're haunted by, we're like, it's like a ghost that we can't shake, you know? And he kind of attributes it to, like, capitalism. He's kind of like a sort of a Marxist, I think, in the philosophical sense of, you know, viewing things as, like, through the lens of class struggle and things like that. But, and I don't know, I'm not saying that that's necessarily what's going on. That's just his thesis. But the idea is, like, post-pop is, like, breaking out of stuck culture. Like, how do we get past stuck culture? Well, we've got to transcend pop, because pop is the force that has, like, colonized our brains, you know, our culture.
And so are you pro-pop or anti-pop?
I mean, it's not inherently bad or good, other than just, like, its grip is so strong we can't break out. Like, it's like saying, are you pro, you know, the realists or the pro-romantics, you know? It's like a period that happened in art, which, you know, some of it's good, some of it's bad. But we have to move past it. We have to, like...
How do you move past?
Well, that would be the challenge of post-pop, the magazine, is, like, different writers... get showing us how they envision moving past it, you know?
Would it break every form that's ever been known to poetry? Going back to form?
Like, what excites me about it is, like, I don't know the answer. I want to see, like, the best writers, what their answer is, you know? And it could be a lot of things. I don't know. It could be, like, return to old forms. That could be one way to do it. You could write, like, poetry using, like, really archaic forms that are, like, super strict and everything, you know? And some poets do that. I know a lot of poets who do that, actually. Or you could go the opposite direction. You could be, like, no rules. You could, like, make stuff that's, like, so hard to read, it's, like, practically illegible or something like that, you know? You could list out, you could do a, you know, a Talon style thing where it's, like, a 5-page poem that just lists out, like, you know, the chemicals that cause autism or something. I don't know, you know what I mean? There's a lot of different ways you could approach it that I think would be sort of pushing against pop, but, like, actually to break through, to, you know, burst the bubble, pop the bubble, whatever you want to say, mm-hmm. I think would be, like, a huge, it's like really the most, it's like climbing Mount Everest for artists. It's like the obvious achievement, you know, like, why climb Mount Everest? Because it's there. Like, getting past pop would be the most, like, transcendent work of artistic genius. Because we're trapped in it, you know what I mean?
But then wouldn't it, if it became popular and, like, you move past it, wouldn't that just become pop?
Well, I don't think pop is necessarily just popular, because, like, there's a lot of art that's pop that's underground and not popular, you know? It's more like a set of instincts. Like I said, it's a way of policing yourself to make stuff that fits within a certain bucket, like to make the 2.5-minute song, you know? But But yeah, I think the bottom line is kind of like, I don't know what it is, but I want to challenge, you know, writers I like to like try, you know?
What writers do you like right now who are writing too poppy and that you want to break them out?
You know?
What writers do you like right now who are writing too poppy and that you want to break them out? Like Steph?
It's not that I'm not criticizing. Nobody, I think we're all guilty of it because it's okay. It's like fish swimming in water, you know, they don't know they're wet type thing. You know what I mean? We're all stuck in it and we can't get out of it. So it's not like there's specific writers where I'm like, oh, you're doing too poppy stuff, you know? It's more like, how do we get out? But, you know, writers I like Tao Lin a lot. I really like, do you know Anna Carrete?
I've heard of them.
Yeah, she's amazing. I love her stuff. Really love her writing. I love Steph Duhem, her writing.
Have you read her books?
Yeah.
She like wrote like a book with her dad.
Oh, I haven't read that then. Yeah, I read her chapbook that she put out through that like British press, you know?
Yeah, I bought that too. Yeah, it was really good.
Yeah.
Then it closed down.
Yeah, they did close down. Yeah, no, I didn't know about. Oh, maybe she did. Maybe I saw something about the thing with her dad where like, because he's an artist and so he did the art or something like that.
Yeah.
I guess I haven't read all her books. Maybe.
I think he's the only person ever wrote like a children's book and is also like involved at Alt-Lit.
Is Steph?
Yeah. I don't think anyone else has written a children's book.
That's interesting. I wonder if that... I can't think of anyone else who has either, but it seems like there's got to be others, but I don't know.
To write a children's book and also be an Alt-Lit. I feel like it's two completely separate, like universes almost.
Yeah, I mean, I would say so, yeah.
Would you write a children's book? That's a whole different business, man.
Yeah. I don't think I have, like, those types of instincts. I don't consider myself someone who, like...
That could be post-pop, though.
It could be, although YA is extremely pop, you know?
Yeah, but it wasn't a YA novel. It was a...
more like a picture book?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that could be post-pop, yeah.
But that's so daring. Would you do it? I don't know.
I would.
It's too experimental.
I just don't consider myself someone who's got, like, the... You know, I don't know how to, like, channel the magic of childhood, really. That's not... I'm too, like...
If it was explicitly bad on purpose to be post-pop, would you go for it?
That would be one way to take on the challenge of making post-pop writing, but that's like part of the problem is that, you know, if you're just making your writing as unreadable and bad as possible,
yeah,
I guess that's post-pop, but it's sort of like you're still having this problem where you're not connecting with readers or you know, your art's not impacting people.
Does post-pop connect with the readers?
Well, it should. Like, is there a way to connect with readers without relying on pop instincts? I don't know.
You don't want anything about superheroes, probably.
Well, maybe you could subvert that somehow in a way that made it post-pop. I don't know. I don't have the answers. I'm just asking the question, you know? I think the question's interesting.
Are you building, like, an Avengers team or, like, an Ocean's 11 team?
For the mag?
Yeah. Are you getting away with a heist?
Yeah, I think it's like, well, I was kind of inspired by Lorca. Had a he had a lit mag that was like super short lived. I think they got like two issues out before they gave up on it, but it was called El Gallo, like the rooster. And and it was like he was trying to break out, like at the time in Spanish poetry, a certain type of poem was really like romantic Spanish poetry had been popular. And then there had been this movement called the Ultraistas who were like super focused on like the image and like stripping everything away, but the image. And he was sort of like trying to move past all that. And so he created this mag called, El Gallo that was trying to move past these movements that were popular at the time. And I think in some ways where things landed was like surrealism. Surrealism is sort of like an attempt to move past these prior ideas. So that's what kind of inspired me, is like if you were doing a magazine today and you wanted to move past, they wanted to go beyond where we're at, what would that be? How would you do that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because this is my big criticism of lit mags in general, is like there are so many lit mags that like they don't have any thesis. There's no underlying thesis. What are they trying to tell you? It's just like, here's writing that we picked from a slush pile, and it's sort of like, okay, maybe the editor, you like his or her taste, so maybe you read it. That's fine. But like, to me, a lit mag should have like some kind of thesis. There should be some like idea that it's putting out there. and very few, like, just like think of the Lit Mags, you know, like most of them don't really have any like animating idea. They're just sort of like, hey, here's stuff we got that we thought was cool, you know?
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the problems with that Hobart thing where like everyone, I don't think anyone knew what like the editors on that, the ones that all left, they didn't even know who Elizabeth Ellen was. Like they didn't even know the foundation, or they didn't know like the origins of the magazine. They hadn't even like done any research. If they had done any research into the mag, they probably wouldn't have been editing for it in the first place.
Yeah, yeah, that's
so
right.
I think it's actually probably a good thing that like there was that big exodus.
Oh, I definitely do. I think if you look at it prior to that, it'd become kind of like an MFA, you know, dumping ground for, you know, MFA students to try to get something on their little CV or whatever. And I think the editors were probably all just academic affiliated people. And it was just, that's why I don't like MFAs. Like the stuff that comes out of those things, it's just so boring. And
I think it lost its voice or place. And
yeah.
It became muddled in what the point was. And
yeah,
it had to reinvent itself.
Yes. And it's better now. Yeah.
What do you think? What's your, that's one of the things you were talking about, like the point of the voice of a magazine. That's why I really like Misery Tourism. I saw you published there. Did you ever go to Misery Loves Company?
No, I never been. I've had poems in Misery Tourism, but I've never attended one of their things. No.
Did you ever think about it?
No, I can't see myself ever really doing like joining like a live stream type. I mean, I guess I would if I was invited, but like on a Friday night or something, I'm not gonna like log on to Zoom, you know.
Mm-hmm. So how did you find out about them? Because it was surprising to see like someone that had been like from Benago Street into Mystery Tourism, because they kind of feel like a step forward, I guess.
Yeah.
From Alt Lit.
Yeah.
Like adjacent to Alt Lit. Do you see them as Alt Lit?
Yeah, I do. I would say so. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you know, who knows what Alt Lit is anymore. In some ways it's a little bit of a joke, right? Like people use it almost like with a humorous way, I think, nowadays. But
I mean, like in 2017 you couldn't even say
it got like hella canceled big time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why it's been revived in an almost like ironic way, I think, you know.
Earlier you said like Alt Lit 1.0.
yeah, yeah.
Like, I don't even know what that is. I just know what Alt Lit is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would consider it like the Tao Lin, Steve Rogenbuck, Sam Pink, you know, Mira Gonzalez, that mm-hmm. that crew. And then it blew up. Are you familiar with like the whole thing with like Stephen Tully Dirks and all that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it blew up with that, and then of course Rogenbuck had his own issues, and then like you said, in 2017-ish it became like totally off limits to even like, you had to like pretend like it was erased from history. And then now it's been revived in like an ironic way, but yeah. So I consider
translating
pre-meltdown, you know.
I think translating is post-pop.
Yeah, I think so. I think so too. Yeah, I would say so. I can tell you that it's not popular.
Yeah.
It hasn't been selling like flying off the shelves or anything, but
are there hit translators?
There are definitely people in the world of translation who are like in high demand, but almost all for like novels, you know what I mean? I mean,
I feel like the way you did it out of like pure love for the art is probably the best way to go.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, if you're just hired by some artist you've never heard of before to translate their book or something. Yeah. I think that's a pretty it's cold, sort of sterile way to do it. But yeah, I think if you're like doing it out of like, yeah, passion for the artist, that's, I think it's better. Yeah.
Would you translate someone that's like current today? Like, do you like read like poetry from like Spain or something?
No, I'd like to actually. There was actually a woman in Alt Lit 1.0. Her like face is on unpublished blog posts of a Mexican Panda Express employee. You know that book, right?
No.
The Megan Boyle book.
What is it called? I don't know very much.
It's called like a selected unpublished blog post of a Mexican Panda Express employee.
I've not heard of that.
Yeah, yeah, it's really good, and you should definitely check it out. I highly recommend it. I think it came out through Moomin House, actually.
Oh, wow.
But anyway, there's like the title of the book is written in pen on a cheek, and it's like the profile of a person.
Okay, yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I've so her, the person who is a Spanish poet named something like, I think her last name is Luna, but I don't remember.
Luna Miguel?
Yeah, Luna Miguel. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know what she's up to these days. I haven't heard that.
She's very
like a super prominent figure.
Lucy K. Shaw, I think.
Say that again?
Lucy K. Shaw and her, I think, are like really good friends.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So that would be someone I'd love to translate. I would love to translate a Luna Miguel collection. Maybe I should. I should try to figure out if there are any. Like I said, she used to be like one of the main, she used to be like a highly active figure within Altley 1.0, but I haven't heard anything about her in forever, you know?
You should translate her book and not even ask. Can you do that?
I mean, I'm sure she has copyright. Yeah, but that was one. That was another thing with this translation was...
How did you get away with this? Yeah.
The copyright just lapsed. This is the first year the copyright has lapsed.
For real?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So wait, were you planning on that then?
No, actually, when during the process, I started looking it up because I started thinking about like, oh, maybe I'll... Like, I really didn't start the project to publish it, truly. But then when I was doing it, I was like, what if I wanted to publish it? And so I started looking into it and I was like, holy shit, it's lapsing like right now, you know? That felt like a little bit of like divine coincidence type thing.
Yeah.
You know?
So how doesn't it take like 100 years for copyright to pass?
It's a little less than that. I want to say it's like, I don't remember anymore, but it's like 92 or something weird like that, you know?
92?
Yeah.
Why 92?
Well, because they originally it was less and then they kept tacking on more and more. I don't know, like, this is probably boring, but like Sonny Bono, you know Sonny Bono?
Yeah. He's very
yeah. Cool. When he was in Congress, like every single time the copyrights were about to lapse for like the original Disney characters, he would pass a bill to extend it like another however many years because he was like, you know, in LA working for Hollywood and Disney and stuff.
Wait, Sonny Bono fought for Disney?
Oh yeah, that was like his biggest issue when he was in Congress was, you know, he was a congressman. And
the singer?
Yeah, yeah, the singer.
Are mm-hmm. you for real?
Yeah, yeah, man.
I didn't know this.
He was like the rep from LA.
And, the guy that got hit, that he was skiing and he hit a tree and died?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
The guy that sang with Cher?
Yes, Tony yes, Cher. That's wow. the one. Yeah, and so one of his biggest things was anytime the Disney copyrights were starting to expire, he would... put forth a bill that would always pass to extend it like another 10 years or something. So
Would it pass just because people liked him?
Well, because it was just like, it's like, you know, the problem of government where, you know, there's people who like, because people with money wanted it to pass. Disney had money, you know, and other content creators had money that wanted it to pass. Like, you know, there's this whole problem of like in government where like, you know, if the price of sugar goes up 10 cents a bag, consumers probably lose like billions of dollars, right? It's huge for consumers. Mm-hmm. Yet there's zero constituency to keep the price of sugar low among consumers. You and I will never band together and start a coalition to keep sugar prices 10 cents lower.
Yeah.
But sugar producers will definitely band together to make them 10 cents higher. You know what I mean? So
sense.
Even though the damage to people is huge collectively, it's too small individually to do anything. I think that's like the copyright issue is that nobody cares that much whether Mickey Mouse goes into the public domain except Disney, you know,
yeah.
And they'll fight to the death over it.
So when did Sonny Bono go into Congress? Like he ran for Congress?
Like in the '80s. Yeah. He was steady in Congress for like a decade. He was in it when he died.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you know this?
good question. I don't know, man. Just reading internet stuff, I guess. I don't know.
Are you into Sonny Bono?
No.
That'd be crazy if you're like a big Sonny Bono fan.
No, I'm not. How do you feel about him?
I knew nothing about him. I just remember when he died and we had a school assembly. Like they announced it or something.
Yeah,
it's so weird.
When Sonny Bono died?
I guess maybe we were already in an assembly, but like it was weird how it got announced. I just remember being like
that
in a
gym. That is very weird.
It's strange. I was like in elementary school.
Where did you go to elementary school? What part of the country?
Tulsa. That's where I live.
Tulsa, Oklahoma?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Cool. That's weird that in Tulsa, Oklahoma, they were like announcing the death of Sonny Bono. I thought if you were from like LA, maybe or something.
Yeah. It was like in the '90s. I don't think very many people died. Well, I guess, I don't know. I have no idea. I was a kid. Where'd you go to?
Probably in the '90s, there were more adults who cared about Sonny Bono than there are today. So it was like a big deal to them, you know, whereas nowadays it's like a lot of people don't know him.
Where'd you go to school?
In elementary school and stuff?
Yeah. Austin?
I've always been in Austin, yeah. Yeah.
Why didn't you move?
It's a good question, man. That's a really good question. I've thought about that like so much in my life. I guess like the short answer would be that I never like found a good reason to leave. Like Austin's been growing a lot it's like grown with me, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was like kind of a sleepy college town when I was a kid, and now it's like this sort of bustling hub. And So it's been easy to stay here and just kind of like grow along with it, you know? I don't know. I just never, like, I've explored living other places, but I was like, nothing ever made any sense. Like, there's fun places where the cost of living is high, and then there's like not so fun places where it's cheap, but like Austin just always felt like the right blend, and I never left.
Have you gone to Joe Rogan's comedy show?
No, I never have. I never have. People say it's like super high security, like
For
you get,
real?
yeah, it's like going to the airport, like they scan you and pat you down and all this stuff. I've heard people say it like kind of sucks for that reason. It feels like a little bit like you're on lockdown or something.
What's the best bookstore in Austin?
Good question. You know, there's this one called Alienated Majesty that people do readings and stuff at. It's kind of like the indie, I guess the main indie bookstore. I don't really go there. I mean, honestly, the only bookstore I ever really go to is Book People, which is it's are you familiar with Book People?
Yeah, I've been there before.
Oh, cool. Oh, you've been to Austin?
Yeah, my cousin lives down there, and I went down there for a few days.
Oh, do you come often?
No, just that once. It was a few years ago. I might go again.
Yeah, I've seen Tao Lin read at Book People a couple of times. That's where he always hits when he comes through.
Oh, he's been down there?
He did a he toured on Taipei, and then I think also on Trip. I think he made a
Okay.
stop in Austin.
Is he real boring?
No, I love. Have you ever been? I mean, he's great to hear read. He's like awesome. I love seeing Tao Lin read
Okay.
and also talk. Like he'll do a Q&A after the reading, and like I'll tell you, like the first way I ever learned about him was like Cree Alt Lit. I used to read this blog called The Rumpus. I don't know if you ever heard of
Yeah.
that or anything. It's pretty corny, honestly, in retrospect, but it was like one of the only sort of somewhat indie lit sites, Cree Alt Lit. And I'd never heard of Tao Lin, and they did like a review of one of his books, and like one of his super early books. And in the comments to the article, he was like, "Ask me any question, and I'll answer it." And people just started commenting, asking him like all sorts of personal questions and stuff. And he was like just unabashedly answering everything, like giving just super straightforward answers, like super personal stuff and everything. And I was like, that's insane. Like I'd never seen anything like that before. It was like performance art to me, you know? And anyway, reason I tell that story is like that's how his Q&As are after his reading. Like he'll answer anything. And people ask him, like, it's like people know that, and they'll ask him like weird stuff and he'll just answer it, you know?
Have you asked him anything?
I don't have the, yeah, I've asked him stuff, but more like
Like what?
normal questions. I've never had the courage to ask him like something really weird, you know?
What'd you ask him?
Damn, good question. What did I ask Tao Lin? Dude, I don't remember. I
Okay.
know I asked him a question at the last reading I saw him at, but just in the Q&A thing, but I don't remember what it was. It was
Did
boring.
he recognize you?
The second time, so I've seen him at two readings, and the second time he did recognize me. Yeah, he was like, "Oh yeah, I remember you." Because we had also like we've exchanged. I've emailed with him a fair bit over the years. So he's like, "Oh yeah, you're the guy that was at my last reading," and we email sometimes. Yeah,
He remembered you from the readings.
he said he did. I mean, I don't. You know, maybe he was just being kind. I don't know.
Did he come up to you? He's like, that guy.
No,
Like, he's cool.
I got in
Oh.
line with other people to get my book signed by him after he read. Yeah, it wasn't.
Did you tell him that you were at his other reading and then he recognized you?
Yeah, and I also bought like a painting from him. Well, I was like, when I was getting my book signed, he was like, "Oh yeah, you bought that painting from me."
Oh.
Yeah, so I don't know. That's I think probably what he remembered most about me.
Did you hang a painting up?
Yeah, I've got it in my house.
Yeah? Oh, that's
It's
cool.
cool. Yeah, it's not a painting actually. It's more like a it's like different colored paper that he cut out and pasted on like a big piece of paper, you know.
What's your favorite talent, like, piece of writing?
I really like his poetry. I really like on he's got like an ebook I really like that's called like this ebook. No, this emotion was a little ebook on Bear Parade. It's still online, you can find it, but it's really old. I like his first two books of poetry. The first one's like, I think you're a little bit happier than I am, and the second one is Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. Those are both awesome. I think they're two of the best books, you know, ever. I like his novels too. I've read everything he's published.
Is the one on Bear Parade, isn't that the one that like him and Kevin Samsel like kind of argued over, like over the edits?
I don't know, but I think I know what you're referring to, where he published like his emails with an editor who was trying to like push all these edits on him, and he basically told the guy to screw off and stuff like that.
No, it's like it's very, I was reading it like just the other day, he didn't tell him to screw it. It gets very like they went back and forth. Like you could tell it's almost like one generation almost like clashing with another. Because the editor that was editing Tao Lin had like you could tell like maybe was almost treated the way that he was treating Tao Lin. But Tao Lin had like read so many books. He had almost had a receipt, and every edit that was suggested, he would like he would say, "No, I'm not going to do that because of this reason, because of this book that I read." And he just had receipts for everything. He was very confident in what he wanted to do. And this Kevin guy just like was clashing over every little thing. And then eventually they were like, "Yeah, this isn't working out." But then the guy, like,
I know exactly what you're talking about. I've read that. Was that on his like old blog, Reader of Depressing Books? Yeah, yeah. I used to read that a lot. Yeah, I know exactly the exchange you're talking about. I've read that.
But then the guy like called Tao Lin immature, and I was like,
Yeah. I know exactly. That is awesome, dude. That kind of stuff. That's the stuff that I like. It made me love him so much, and like a lot of his ideas around subjectivity in art and like abstraction in language versus concrete language. I love a lot of his like ideas like that. Really influenced by those. In fact, I wish he'd talk about that more. And you know, he's so into his like kind of like pet topics these days, which is fine. He's entitled. But I really liked how he had a lot to say about stuff like that, art and language and writing, you know.
Yeah, you like old. I like old telling.
I do too. I love him, actually. I mean, he was my introduction to a lot of like all this stuff. So, yeah, but I consider him like the best, man. I think he's one of the best writers of the last, you know, 50 years of a generation, you know. I think he's like the best millennial writer, maybe.
Has he ever translated anything?
Has Tao?
Yeah, I don't think so.
I have seen, I can almost be certain I've seen him post like Chinese language poem, because he speaks like Chinese or Taiwanese. I think it's the same. I don't know enough about it to know if that's different, but I know he speaks a little bit about that. But I think I've seen him post like little snippets of like poems and things he's translated.
It's been almost an hour and a half. I think it's
short. Damn. It flew by, man. I really like talking to you, Tyler. I could talk a lot more, man. This has been great. Thank you for entertaining me and letting me kind of like ramble so much.